We admitted it.
Thank you. And that was, you took the first line of my opening monologue here, but I guess there we have it. You know, we have step 10, and where are we at? You know, we've done steps 1 through 9. Here we are at 10. That means the first deep dive in house cleaning of the past and the immediate present sometimes is done. And so where do we go from here? So I'm going to start with my favorite, As Bill Sees It. And I love this book so much. According to a Grapevine article, 1961, February, many of us would presume to declare, "Well, I'm sober and I'm happy. What more can I want or do? I'm fine the way I am." We know that the price of such self-satisfaction is an inevitable backslide, punctuated at some point by a very rude awakening. We have to grow or else deteriorate. For us, the status quo can only be for today, never for tomorrow. Change we must. We cannot stand still. That kind of sums it up. I mean, we're going forward or we're going backward. We're going toward a drink or we're going away from a drink. I'm going to depart a little bit, but I want to... This popped into my head when it occurred to me when I was preparing for this. And it is... I think it kind of encapsulates to me with the 10th step and as we live it and as we get sober and stay sober and live better is this. And according to Maya Angelou, she says, "Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better." And I think that kind of covers, you know, that kind of distills down a lot of our 10th step. It just leaves out a lot of the how-tos and the whys and wherefores. It just gives us kind of quickly the action. And I've always, and even more so now as I'm sent back to the books and preparing every week to come here, you know, what a great borrower our Bill was and how much smart thinking and solid religious thinking and medical thinking and smart people who had a lot of insight into the human condition, how much he borrowed from everybody and put it together in material that applied to us as people try to not take a drink today. So that also... In a letter from Bill Wilson, 1966, says, "Day by day, we try to move a little toward God's perfection. So we need not be consumed by maudlin guilt." I love his verbiage too, maudlin guilt. It just paints a picture for me. "Maudlin guilt for failure to achieve his likeness and image by Thursday next. Progress is our aim, and his perfection is the beacon, light years away, that draws us on." So, you know, that I read that, and it's kind of tells me that just I do the best I can do today. I spot what's going on with me today and try to do better. I guess if Maya Angelou wrote when Bill Wilson was around, that might have been somewhere in our materials as well. But the 12 and 12 book, I'm not going to use that too much today because I read it and it goes through a whole lot of nuts and bolts how-to information, and it breaks out, you know, the daily inventory and the spot check inventory and the episodic inventory. And I'm going to kind of leave you all to it on that and hope that you use that book for some direction on nuts and bolts specifics and what we do. I also would refer you to the book Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect. And I've been attending the meeting that has been studying the Drop the Rock book and the Ripple Effect book lately. And I want to mention this Ripple Effect book because that is kind of, that book explores step 10 is ongoing work on step 6 and 7. Which is kind of an interesting framework. So I've been attending that meeting and studying that, and the readings kind of relate to that. Because as you remember, for steps 6 and 7 is becoming more aware of our character defects and developing some willingness to let them go and asking God to take them from us so that we can go forward and do less daily bad stuff that we need to make ongoing amends for. So I just wanted to mention that to you. This week, you know, the real guts of it, I found this book was really helpful as far as looking at how to explain this. In living, I look daily. I sometimes look parts of the day. The longer I'm sober, the harder it is for me to stay sober. And I know when I do wrong stuff. Like my stomach tells me I've done something wrong. My fluttering heart tells me I'm doing something wrong, you know, that is not in accordance to how I would want to live as a sober woman, as a person of dignity and recovery and integrity. You know, I want my inside standards to match up well with my outside actions. Being a human being, I don't always hit that benchmark. And when I don't, if I shortchange or try to cheat a little or, you know, look for an easier, softer way, a lot of times my stomach tells me, my fluttering heart tells me, that unsettledness in the guts. I guess I got a lot of in the guts stuff. You know, different people have different parts of their bodies that tell them when things aren't right and when they're not doing right. But this book, just to show it to you for those who are present that you see this, Joe McHugh, he looks to have borrowed really heavily from the big book, and that impressed me too. But he talks about, now I almost panicked, I found a blank page in my notes and it found out I just skipped a page. I flipped two pages at once. But if he notes again, you know, like anything else, how many of you had a sponsor who said, well, if you're having a problem with this step, you should go back and look at the ones ahead of them, right? And that's what Joe McHugh talks about. If you're having trouble with step 10, maybe you're not done with steps 1 through 9 yet. But he also talks about using step 10 to live well in recovery. He says some interesting things here. And I'm going to like share some of this book and then talk about like my own life and my experience with it interspersed. But I thought this was really smart and it kind of hit me. He said, first, we have a spiritual life and we can live it in harmony or disharmony. First of all, I never had one really till I got here. I would have somewhat of a religious life, I guess, of observance, but not necessarily connected. Most people live with it in disharmony. Now, I know as an active drunk and as a person in early recovery, this was me, loud and clear. Most people live with it in disharmony. Many people go and do what they want to do and then listen to their inner direction. Now, I've been way guilty of that. And my beloved late father-in-law used to call people like that ignorance in motion. And I've been guilty of that, just going off and doing something and then thinking about it later. And then Joe McHugh goes on to say, rather than listening to the inner direction and then deciding what to do. That's a big leap in recovery. That is a big leap in recovery for me to look at the situation, talk about it to, you know, a sponsor, to someone I trust, you know, maybe figure out how do I want to address this, you know, how do I want to make a decision. So he also phrases it as, so life emanates from the inside out, from the spiritual to the mental to the physical, you know. So I have that, you know, I have a feeling, I think it through, I talk it through, and then I act. That's better living. He also talks about, you know, that fourth dimension part. And I'll be honest, I don't know if I still understand what the fourth dimension is, if it means living better and sometimes being astounded that I've behaved in a way that I was totally incapable of behaving before, and I mean in a good way, then I guess that's it. I do believe that our steps are to be lived and felt, not to be studied, thought through like a homework assignment, you know, because really, how much do you all remember your trigonometry from high school? You did that like a homework assignment. That's not real stuff. But things we learned, you know, by living through and experiencing and taking it to heart, I get, you know, that's what I get. But how he describes is that if we can grow spiritually and mentally and in right relationship to the physical world, we are going to expand in the fourth dimension. And I share that because I don't really quite still know what that means. Oh, and I forgot to qualify myself. I'm an alcoholic, so I'm qualified to speak here at any AA meeting. At any AA meeting. And in this meeting, he asked for 30 years consecutive recovery. So I had my last drink February 23rd, 1981. So I like to qualify for each disc just because people may listen to it, you know, disc by disc, and there it is. So yeah, 1981, that was a long time ago. I was young then. I'm retired now. So my employers, thank you. You know, everyone since 1981, all of those people, thank you. But anyway, he talks again about, you know, we grow or we die or we go back to a drink, which for us is to die. So he describes it as step 10 is a way to enter the plan of continuous growth. We can't remain at a certain part. Everything is either growing or deteriorating. And it's simple, and it's redundant, and it's boring, and it is true. We go forward or we go backward. We get better or we get worse. It is the lady or the tiger. We live or we die. We have a fatal disease. And so if we want to be well and live well and happy, I need to recognize that fact. I need to live my days out in recognition of that simple fact. That's not maudlin. That's a life-opening thing. That's not a death sentence at all, the fact that I have a fatal disease of alcoholism. If I treat it right, I've opened the doors to everything, you know, and letting God help me along the way. So he talks about our character defects or what cause our resentment. And I think that's true, you know, whenever I get agitated, and we've learned from our previous work, and I've learned from my previous work, you know, we look at resentments and then we look what's underneath them. You know, I resent so and so, and it's because my fear has been touched off, or my fears about money or my ego or something, and I start to act out on it. But a lot of the discomforts that we have ongoing are still caused by these character defects and these resentments and fears and guilt and remorse. It's these four things. They come back forever and ever, and whenever there's something wrong with me, that's it, you know. And I was in a meeting earlier today, and we were talking about circumstances. And, you know, it was still, I could identify another fear of something that I didn't want to be responsible for, yet feared would be shoved off on me, you know, because I didn't want to do this. I don't think I should, but it was a fear still. You know, my humanity didn't go away. I didn't take a drink today, but I'm still human and still have all those feelings. See, the difference is I have a way to address it now. So he talks about when these things come up and I'm resentful or I'm mad. You know, there was one of the biggest differences I find from when I was earlier on in recovery and later on in recovery, it meant I had more practice at working a program. And at this point in recovery, I've worked through the first set of steps through 9, and the past is cleaned up. But I'm still here. And the point I'm trying to make is when I was newer, I didn't recognize things as fast. I didn't want to let myself recognize things as fast. And basically, I would torture myself over things for a lot longer than now, with more practice and more talking to people and more, you know, going back to the books and to the meetings and really, you know, self-honesty and honesty with others. I torture myself for a shorter period of time because I'm willing to take a look at things. So the questions when I'm distressed, and how Joe McHugh lays it out and I think is really helpful, when I do something that I feel is wrong or someone makes me mad, the questions I would need to ask myself is, am I being selfish? Am I being self-seeking? Am I being dishonest? Am I being inconsiderate? Am I being fearful? That's a lot of territory. That's not a bad little inventory of a daily upset or a daily fluttering stomach. What's wrong here? You know, have I been inconsiderate? Do I owe an apology? Am I being fearful? Is there anything to it? Or is this something I need to hand over to God? Am I being self-seeking? Is that a matter of degree? You know, am I earning my paycheck or am I trying to take something from you to your detriment? You know, those are all questions that when a discomfort arises. But, you know, what the suggestion is when I come up with a resentment or a fear, instead of thinking of how you're wrong or I'm just so resentful, maybe the better way is, what part of me is being affected? What part of me feels threatened? Because most of the time when I react badly, I'm feeling threatened. I'm feeling defensive, and I'm going to fight for myself. That's human nature. That's my nature. Those things keep coming back, and that's the purpose of a 10th step inventory, whether it is daily, you know, situationally through the day or episodically. I wrote all these wonderful notes and I'm really trashing them. But this really, underneath it all, you know, it goes back to giving to God things that are God's and tapping into that higher power. That's how I have learned to live better, is through letting God run things for me better, by taking the direction that is sent to me through all of you people. I do hold that belief, and it's worked for me. God's always underneath it all. However it's manifested, God's underneath it all. It's often said that we are spirits having a human experience, and I do believe that at this point, and I would have laughed at this 30 years ago. I just would have, you know, I would have bought into there's a higher power. The older I get, maybe the more open-minded I get about that sort of thing, or the less I need to have some identifiable image. But step 10 is a plan for continuous growth in our efforts to strive for our ongoing well-being. You may remember in the big book, it talks about being happy, joyous, and free. That's really the idea. That's the game plan, that we can live happy, joyous, and free. We can live comfortable in our own skin. I can't live comfortable in my own skin if I'm at odds with people. I just can't. I have to settle it, maybe not to their satisfaction, but to the level that I feel I've met my moral obligation, you know, that I've lived up to my internal standard that I have learned and gotten through the rooms of AA and all of you good people along the way. That's important. So it is a lifelong process. It's an unending process. Some people call step 10 a maintenance step. Some call it a growth step. As I was studying and reading this, and maybe over just living and ruminating, but with study, it's like a step of, again, coming into a maturity, you know, coming into living like a person of integrity, of dignity, of self-respect. I've had opportunity to talk to more than a few incarcerated women, and one of the things that always struck me and that would get talked about, we would talk about, was about being a woman of dignity and self-respect and how that plays into things and how simple, you know, starting to gain some self-respect is, even on a daily basis, you know, when we would get down to basics like, you know, women of self-respect wash their face every day. They keep their hair clean. You know, they put on fresh clothes. That self-respect can be as simple as that or as complex as moral philosophy. But I think step 10 starts to come about and work helps me work toward developing more maturity and letting God help me return to the character He intended me to have. I really, you know, my beliefs are, I don't think God didn't send me to the rooms of AA to remain a drunk and to live like a drunk and to live without dignity and integrity and self-respect. I think God made me to live happy, joyous, and free. I need to get out of the way and return to that intended state, and step 10 is part of that. So whenever I'm uncomfortable, again, that is my character defects flaring up. And in the past 6 months, I think, you know, I think it fits in because step 10, again, you know, it's surrender, it's surrender, it's surrender, and it's still more surrender to the honesty, to submitting to the process, you know, that AA teaches us, you know, to figuring out how we make that process work for us or how we adopt that thought process into our life so that we can live well, so that we find ourselves less and less in the wrong and having to make prompt amends. And I have to say, you know, the longer I let amends lay around in current situations, the less happy I am. I got to get it done because I'm not comfortable anymore. See, I have to be drunk to be comfortable carrying bad stuff. I have a hard time carrying bad stuff when I'm not drunk. You know, it's like the lady in Freedom from Bondage when she talks about you can't do these steps and be drunk. And you can't be drunk and do these steps. And so I keep going back to her, but she's, that's a wonderful story, and it's almost the very last in the big book, and it was about a young woman And I was a young woman when I came into the room, so this was a story I read again and again, and I would read it, and I would cry, and I would read it again, and I would cry some more, and this was in the phase when I couldn't sleep, so I'd be up half the night reading and crying, and there it is. But she talks about that, you know, we can't do that, but surrender the process. He notes pain, you know, that pain is a symptom. I talked about the fluttering in the stomach, that emotional pain. That means there's something wrong with me. There's something I need to look at. There's something going on that I'm not facing, not recognizing. He also talks about He talks about the importance of living in the solution. Oh my God. Talks about, and he mentions, and I want to say this because I've heard, you know, if we go and talk about our problems and take our problems like to the meeting and everyone just says, I have the same problem. Yeah, I have that problem too. Oh yeah, I had that problem last week. And then we say thank you and good night. All we've heard about is problems. That's not an AA meeting. You know, we're about solutions here. So I wanted to mention that, and I felt I always kind of felt like a B word, thinking like, where's the solution? You know, and I was taught when I early that, you know, problems were for sponsors and close friends, solutions were for meetings. So I'm going to throw that out there. You can throw it away if you like, but I wanted to mention that. So, and finally, when we do all this, and I didn't see it this way, but the big book, the Joe McHugh calls what we get out of the big book and from doing step 10 is the next little set of promises. And he says that we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. And this is like a fruit. This is a fruit of step 10. I hope I made myself clear in explaining that. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. The problem has been removed. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. This is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And Joe McHugh described that as the promises, you know, the extra promises that come with working step 10. By living well now and staying spiritually fit, that we're able to meet life's situations. The book also reminds us that alcohol is a subtle foe. It's always out there waiting for me. You know, it's always out there waiting for me. And as long as I'm here and half sane, then I don't want to. I've had my butt kicked often enough by alcohol. I'm not looking for another round, and I'm much older and tireder now. But it talks a lot about God consciousness, and God is very much a part of that, because this is a spiritual program. There's no spiritual side of the program. It's all spiritual. It's embrace it and work it. But that's how it is, you know. And again, they used to say that if God chases them out, the booze will chase them back in. I believe that now. I didn't necessarily believe that then. But, you know, the importance of fit spiritual condition is real clear. It's made real clear. Whatever that looks like for you, but there has to be some spirit connection somewhere. You know, the higher power, the God as we understand God. And it finally, it talks about, to some extent, and this is what the big book tells us, to some extent we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. So some of this stuff is kind of witchy, and we get rocketed into a fourth dimension, and we develop a vital sixth sense. But the last couple things I want to say is about this. From a Bill Wilson letter, 1966, "We first reach for a little humility, knowing that we shall perish of alcoholism if we do not. After a time, though we may still rebel somewhat, we commence to practice humility because this is the right thing to do. Then comes the day when, finally freed in large degree from rebellion, we practice humility because we deeply want it as a way of life." And, here we go. And this is from the big book, but I have it marked here because it talks about as we've returned to sanity, you know, that we're not cocky and we're not afraid. But it talks about assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. And it goes on with, you know, movies with drinking or friends who may still drink or relatives or have alcohol in their home, or that people shouldn't have to hide their bottles. We live in the world as it is. I've had to learn to live in the world as it is, and you can too. I know you can if by working the steps, because if we do these steps, the book promises us we'll be placed in a position of safety. Safe neutrality, not cocky, not afraid, just okay. And it talks, but I'm going to skip some, and it talks about we meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance of sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. So that's all I have to say about step 10. And for more nuts and bolt how-tos, please go to the 12 and 12 because it lays it out perfectly. So thank you. And I talked long enough. There shouldn't be much time for questions. So I try.
Thanks, Leslie. So that brings us to our question and answer portion. Who has a question for Leslie to get us started?
Thank you, Leslie. That was interesting, the way you brought in information from different sources. I enjoyed that. So here's my question. Do you prescribe a mechanical working of step 10, as in every night or every morning or twice a day, or do you prescribe working step 10 when your gut tells you you need to work step 10?
I would prescribe both. Because there's nothing wrong with just taking a quick review of the day. I try to do that. But, you know, when it's something is troubling me, I got to look at it. And I'm not sure what there, for me, what's to be gained by waiting too much. So I think there's a place for all of those practices, you know, a routine daily. And he explains it very nicely in the Joe McHugh book about, you know, he explains it better, so I would say look at it and let him explain better than me. But no, I think there's a place for both. And I also think I've gone on retreats where that's a time to step away from the day-to-day and review things and talk things over, you know, seek out some counsel and direction, and make touch spiritually as well. So that, you know, these periodic and daily and as needed, I think it's all good. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. In the beginning, you said or read something that said, the longer I stay sober, the harder it gets to stay sober.
No, the longer I stay sober, the harder it gets to walk around and carry wrong things inside of me.
Okay.
I can't stay sober, and I have to take care of my issues, my problems, or my conflicts.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes I hear what it, I don't know, but
I'm glad you clarified that. I wouldn't want you to leave thinking
okay.
that.
Well,
you know,
I'm looking for light at the end of the tunnel. So
I'm still an alcoholic, though, you know, and my disease is out there waiting for me anytime I want to indulge it. So anytime I want to feed that disease, you know, and choose the tiger instead of the lady, it's all out there waiting for me. But no, it's harder for me to live wrong and stay sober. I have to clean up things to the best of my knowledge and ability. Kind of like Maya Angelou said, you know, do your best until you know better, then do better. So, but I need a drink to do bad now, you know, or to carry bad. I guess I could do something bad, but I don't live with it so well anymore. That's where the booze comes in. Okay. Hello, Brenda.
Hi. Thank you so much for everything you said tonight. And I loved your question, Paige. I thought that was really something. But here's something I struggle with sometimes. What do you do when you can't grasp the word of being restored to sanity? Because honestly, I don't know how to restore myself to something I never had.
Well, you know...
And I know it sounds funny, but sometimes when I'm doing a tenth and I'm always trying to figure things out. I think alcoholics are always trying to figure things out. And sometimes I wonder if I'm so hard on myself because it has to be me. Hey, there's something wrong with me. Sometimes it's not me, or am I fooling myself?
Huh. Well, you know, to the extent I understand the question, you know, to the extent I understand, the first thing that came to my mind was years ago in one of my early on home groups, it was a group that was filled up with people who were like me then, and I was like about 30 and a couple of years sober, and everybody was kind of like that in this home group, so it was fun for me. But this guy always said, they sent me to rehab, but there was nothing to rehab because they should have sent me to HAB because I had never been habilitated in the first place. I didn't know what to do, you know, and it stuck with me like 30 years later. I can see the guy's face, and he was nuts. I mean, he was really, you know, if you're from Pittsburgh, this would make sense to you, but he was from McKees Rocks, and if you're from Pittsburgh, that says it all, but close enough. I don't know what you would say here, you know, what's the comparable municipality, but, you know, maybe where we started to where we are now is maybe a more fair comparison, you know, because there were some things I never knew how to do or some things I hadn't lived to experience yet, so I don't know if I hadn't done them badly or because I never done them, you know. I didn't have children when I was drunk, so I couldn't have been a bad mother, you know, so... But to compare, you know, the person I was then and my thought process and how I did things and how I treated people and how I viewed myself with the world and the posture I would take, a lot of it was like, I mean, truly like the egomaniac with the inferiority complex, you know, very obnoxious and defensive all at the same time, you know, it's a real trick. But so, you know, I think that's, for me, that's a better measure of how far have I come. And then, in the end, you know, I need to get out of God's way and stop beating myself up so much, too, you know. When you know better, do better. Until you know better, you can't do better. You just do the best you can with what you got today. And I've had to relent on myself a lot on things like that. I was so happy when I found that quote, and it occurred to me again today. But that's kind of it. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Anyone else? Talked you all out? Okay.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.